Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. For a change today, I'm going to read a paper rather than extemporising around the title. This paper is called Nietzsche's Metaphors of War and Play. It starts with three epigraphs. This is the first one, and it's from Ecce Homo on the section about human, all too human, and it's part one. I illuminate with piercing brightness this underworld of the ideal. It is war, but a war without powder and smoke, without warlike attitudes, without pathos and contorted limbs. All this would still have been idealism. The next one is from Beyond Good and Evil, section 211. Genuine philosophers, however, are commanders and legislators. They say, thus it shall be. And the next one, again, is from Beyond Good and Evil, and this is section 94. A man's maturity consists in having found again the seriousness one had as a child at play. Okay, so that's the three quotations from Nietzsche that act as the jumping-off point. So here's the paper proper. In this paper, I consider the roles of metaphors of war and play within Nietzsche's oeuvre, relying particularly on Ecce Homo to what might well be the authoritative synopsis. I hope to show that recognising and mining these metaphors helps to furnish a reading of Nietzsche on philosophy itself, which runs contrary to the attempts to identify a system structuring Nietzsche's project and or a set of propositions which it argues for and confirms. This is contra to trends in Nietzsche scholarship well represented by, for example, John Richardson. So what of the metaphor of war? The prevalence of bellicose imagery found throughout the oeuvre is clearly metaphorical, but what does it stand for? I want to suggest that for Nietzsche, philosophy itself is culture war. How do I come to think that? Firstly, note that the very mention of war, for example, the subtitling of On the Genealogy of Morals, a polemic, brings evaluation centre stage, because if there is war, there must be something the protagonists of each evaluated as worth fighting for. Philosophy, because of its canonical concern for evaluation, both in the matter of specifics and in its generality, is thus connected to war, and moreover war over the philosophical future and therefore the human future. Secondly, note that Nietzsche is in fact explicit that evaluation, with a view to fueling legislation, is a central and self-consciously philosophical concern for him, whilst the quest for proofs is not. His great task, he tells us, is the revaluation of all values, and its method is that of play. And you can find these concerns referenced in the preface of The Will to Power, section 10, and in Ecce Homo, in the chapter entitled Why I Am So Clever, section 10. Firstly, let's consider evaluation. The evaluations that Nietzsche performs are of a host of value-laden cultural forms, including the morality of ressentiment, Platonism, Christianity understood as Platonism for the masses, types of nihilism, the predilection for proofs that runs through the philosophical canon, the psychology of the priest type, and more. They are manoeuvres in his culture war, his attempt to legislate for the future by establishing a new discursivity. Nietzsche claims, for instance, that he, quote, relates the history of the next two centuries, end quote. And that's found in the preface of Will to Power. Evaluation, of which re-evaluation is a species, needs an evaluative standard. For nature, that standard is complex because it does far more than measure and weigh. It pictures actualities and possibilities, so they may be compared aesthetically as well as rationally, and in the light of our desires. It is the binary life affirmation, life negation, and its working out persists throughout nature's thought and is articulated in various ways. Furthermore, it is employed as it is being refined. Life affirmation is thought through in terms of the Dionysian and Amorphati, and in relation to the notions of will to power, the eternal return, and the overman. Indeed, so central is affirmation that much, if not the whole of Zarathustra, is dedicated to the task of elucidating it. And Nietzsche himself makes this clear in Ecce Homo in his section, Thus Spake Zarathustra, at the beginning of that chapter. Life affirmation, it turns out, is a rare beast because there is so much cultural weight given to its opposite. Its highest formulation, Nietzsche tells us in Ecce Homo, Zarathustra, is the eternal return, which is the function of an existential test of our degree of life affirmation. In the same part of Ecce Homo, Nietzsche tells us how a complete life affirmation manifests in an individual's character. Such a one, and Zarathustra is such a one, now I'm quoting, has the harshest, the most fearful insight into reality, has thought the most abysmal thought. Nonetheless, he finds in it no objection to existence, nor even to the eternal recurrence of existence. Rather, one has more reason to be himself, the eternal yes to all things, the tremendous, unbounded yes and amen. And that quote is taken from Ecce Homo, the section on Zarathustra. Furthermore, Nietzsche tells us this is the concept of Dionysus. As far as imagined futures for culture and society are concerned, it's clear that in an affirmative culture should be able to produce such a type of person. Nietzsche doesn't imagine that all citizens of such a culture will be completely life affirmative in the heroic manner he describes in the passage just cited. He is vehemently anti-egalitarian, for instance, see Beyond Good and Evil sections 202 and 203. However, he seeks to legislate, if only as an expression of his abundance, and for a society that is capable of at least not obstructing the emergence of some rare affirmative individuals, and even positively encouraging this. The other pole of the binary evaluative standard, life negation, also expresses itself in individuals' character as well as in culture at large. Let's consider an example. In the case of the ascetic priest, which Nietzsche devotes considerable attention to in On the Genealogy of Morals, the priest's historical role as the determining of mankind's values brings the individual and collective ramifications of life negation together into a single consideration. Hence, the dominant priestly morality of Christendom, with its insistence on the unclean character of sexuality, with its binding imperative to cultivate selflessness, with its turning of a primordial cruelty in on the self, in a quest for subjugation of embodied human nature. All this denies the very foundations of life. And that's a quote from Nietzsche, denies the very foundations of life. The propagation of this morality by the priests is ultimately in service of their power, not only their ascetic power over their own natural tendencies, but also their power as political agents. And this is made clear in Will to Power, section 141. Nietzsche's evaluation of the individual and collective ramifications of the psychology of the priest, as given in The Genealogy of Morals, however, tests the phenomenon against both life negation and life affirmation to produce a highly nuanced reading. Thus, Nietzsche notes something paradoxical in the ascetic priest's attempt to unself and unsex himself. The priest should, as a result of his efforts, be severely weakened. However, he stands proud and vigorous at the head of his flock, enjoying his rhetorical skill and the power it delivers him, and fired in his role by the indifference to pain his ascetic practice of self-cruelty has carefully built up. And we see this described in the third chapter of The Genealogy of Morals, section 13 particularly. The psychological nonsense of life against life is thus brought to light by this examination of the priest phenomenon for the presence of affirmation in the midst of a sea of life negation. Nietzsche notes that the desire to negate life in favour of something higher itself eventually affirms life. After all, the will to efface will is itself will. To disengage from earthly life projects is itself a life project, as Nietzsche puts it. The no which he, the priest, says to life brings, as if by magic, an abundance of tender yeses to light. Even when this master of destruction wounds himself, it is the wound itself which afterwards compels him to live. And this again is in the third chapter of On the Genealogy of Morals. It's the same section, actually, section 13. This binary method of evaluation is a primary tool in the re-evaluating of all values, of engaging in the culture war. Its capacity for nuance should be apparent from the way in which the ascetic priest is not just a simple bogeyman, that he has a necessity and inevitability about him, that he has made life interesting, that he created new perspectives. Nevertheless, he calumniates too many essential and beautiful aspects of life, and at best is to be left behind. What we see here is an exercise of what I want to call the philosophical imagination. Hence, the figure of the priest is an archetype rather than a historically and geographically specific figure. The brushstrokes are very broad and the historical cultural canvas is monumental, even though the genealogy of morals is short and the style condensed. There is a minimal appeal to the messy pile of data which the unfolding of history leaves behind, but the narrative is underdetermined by it, just like any historical narrative, however methodically and minutely the data is attended to. Nietzsche is alert to this underdetermination, if the second untimely meditation is anything to go by, which allows him to be candid about the polemical nature of genealogy of morals and without reference to science. Furthermore, it explains the lack of any scholarly apparatus and the text's impressionist nature. It is on account of the genealogy of morals' polemical nature that there is a pure destructivity present, as well as the nuanced evaluations of cultural phenomena. In the case of genealogy of morals, the genealogical method has as its aim the destruction of the influence of Christian and other moralities. How so? The transcendental claims that purportedly ground morality are brought under suspicion and relocated in the all too human. It is more important to Nietzsche to disempower such moralities than to disprove the set of propositions regarding what is desirable and or obligatory in the matter of human conduct and character they appear to contain. Had Nietzsche been attempting the latter in the genealogy, i.e. engaging in propositional argument, then Father Frederick Copleston's charge of the genetic fallacy would secure Christian morality against this particular Nietzschean attack. And Copleston speaks about this in his huge history of philosophy that was published in 1965. But for Nietzsche's disruptive purposes, it is only necessary to show that it is highly plausible that Christian morality does indeed have an earthy genealogy, and that this is not contradicted by the available facts. The picture of morality as the voice of God in man becomes far less compelling simply because of the vividness of the counter-narrative that Nietzsche elaborates, in which has the appearance of an unmasking. That characterization of morality as the voice of God in man is from Kant. And Nietzsche speaks about all this in Ecce Homo, in the section Why I Am a Destiny. The destructive attacks on the underpinning metaphysics of most moralities hitherto, which recur throughout the oeuvre, add to the convincing nature of the narrative. Hopefully enough has been said to indicate the organising role of the metaphor philosophy is war in the turbulence of Nietzsche's oeuvre. One metaphor isn't enough for Nietzsche, however. I want to suggest by way of an interpretation of a few remarks that Nietzsche makes on the matter of play, that the metaphor philosophy's play also organises the oeuvre, interweaving with the metaphor of war. The first remark in question is this, quote, I know of no other way of dealing with great tasks than that of play. This is, as a sign of greatness, an essential precondition, end quote. And it's from Ecce Homo, Why I'm So Clever. The great task is to undertake the culture war, which is philosophy. This is captured by the formulation, the re-valuation of all values, but also by the final, as it turns out, valedictory words of Ecce Homo. Dionysius against the crucified. But why play? If we take it that Nietzsche here refers to the imaginative play of small children, with which they attempt to understand the world they find themselves in, by imagining clods of earth to be castles, armchairs to be space rockets, by imagining what it is like to die, what it is like to be an adult, figuring out by experiment what the rules of a society are, and so on. This kind of play, I want to suggest, is very close to the philosophical imagination I alluded to earlier, particularly when it aims at an understanding. Clearly, I can't give a detailed phenomenology of play at this juncture, but here are some of the features of imaginative play that are found throughout the Nietzschean oeuvre. The first I call freshness of vision. Nietzsche clearly values the attempt to entertain new perspectives on phenomena of concern. That this is a mode that can be adopted by a philosopher is outlined in the very first aphorism of the non-book, The Will to Power. Quote, of what is great, one must either be silent or speak with greatness. With greatness, that means cynically, and with innocence. And that's in the preface. A young child is new to the world, that is, innocent, and also is spirited, she wants to test what she's told about it. That is, she is cynical. Imaginative play is the mode of conducting this experimentation, exploration and testing, this intense, serious losing of innocence. Furthermore, the significance attributed by Nietzsche to the figure of the child in Zarathustra in the famous Three Metamorphoses points in this direction. The child is innocent, Nietzsche tells us here. Not only that, he or she is a forgetting and a new beginning, a game. In case we think that this doesn't particularly apply to philosophy, we should note that Zarathustra is himself a child, at least according to a saint who encounters him as he descends his mountain. And that reference to the saint is found in the prologue of Zarathustra, section 2. The second feature of Nietzsche's oeuvre that is captured by the metaphor philosophy of play is the unstable and shifting nature of some of Nietzsche's key concepts. The imaginative play of small children can seem capricious. A theme may be suddenly dropped as some new interest catches the child's eye, only to be picked up later with renewed intensity. Linear narrative invention may suddenly veer off on a tangent. In its very openness, imaginative play is prone to be caught by breezes and squalls and becalming in the current of events. Nietzsche's philosophical play is such a dance of shifting metaphors. The world can be will to power, it can be chaos, it can be a mystery we should not question. All this in the quest to form an understanding. Moreover, there is no need for this process to stop. An understanding forged has been forged by imagination, by letting the world be this or that, and then working out the consequences of that letting be. More letting be is always possible, and may be demanded as new conditions arise and new discoveries are made. The shift in metaphoricity of imaginative play clearly destabilises boundaries and perhaps definition itself. It is a play of creation and destruction. Hence, in the Nietzschean herb, we see the concept of the will to power disappearing and reappearing in various guises. At first, it is the primordial drive within human beings. Then it is the cosmological principle in accord with Boscovich's ideas. Then it is but one drive amongst many, the drive that great men have in abundance. The concept of the eternal return is similarly shifting. It's a thought experiment, an existential test. Then it is a cosmic principle, and then the real nature of time. So how can nature wage war by playing? The clue is in the last words I alluded to earlier. Dionysus against the crucified. Each of these protagonists in Nietzsche's wars are metonyms and could be unpacked to furnish an enormous amount of material. We have already seen that Dionysus stands for the life affirmative and the crucified for life negation. Nietzsche is in fact explicit about this in a note contemporaneous with Ecce Homo. Quote, "The God on the cross is a curse on life, a signpost to seek redemption from life. Dionysus, cut to pieces, is a promise of life. It will be eternally reborn and return again from destruction." End quote. And that's you can find that quote in Will to Power, it's section 1052. So both of these are an orientation towards life's tragic character, towards suffering. Furthermore, the playful child of the three metamorphoses is a sacred yea saying, and that's a quote, a sacred yea saying, and is therefore also a symbol of affirmation. The philosophical method of the philosopher Dionysius, of whom Nietzsche is a disciple, is that of play in all its creativity and destructivity. The philosophy inspired by the crucified is otherworldly, ascetic and nihilistic, that is, metaphysical in its ambitions and methods. The combat between these two suffuses almost every page of Nietzsche's oeuvre. To conclude, somewhat polemically, Nietzsche's philosophy as war is a culture war over the human future. Nietzsche himself is gunning for a radical break with life negation as the primary cultural force, even as he plays, perhaps because he plays. Thank you for listening.